This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Giancarlo Esposito, is famous for playing Gus Fring in the series Breaking Bad. His character was killed in Breaking Bad, but now Esposito is back as Gus in season 3 of the prequel, Better Call Saul. Esposito is in several Spike Lee films, including School Days, Do the Right Thing, and Mo Better Blues. He started acting as a child. He was on Broadway by the time he was 8. He's the son of a white father from Italy who worked as a stagehand and carpenter, and an African-American mother from Alabama who was an opera singer. We're going to talk about lots of things, including how race affected his career and his mother's. But let's start with his character, Gus. Gus Fring is an upstanding member of Albuquerque's business community. He founded and runs the fast food chicken restaurants Los Pollos Hermanos. But he has another business the Chamber of Commerce does not know about, as a drug lord overseeing the production and distribution of crystal meth. Here's a scene from this season's Better Call Saul that takes place after Gus's drug rivals came to Gus's restaurant and menaced his staff. After that incident, Gus calls the staff together and gives them a reassuring talk. He promises them overtime and therapy to deal with any lingering trauma or stress. Then the restaurant manager asks Gus a question.
Mr. Fring, who were those guys?
Well, some of you know that many years ago, I opened my first Los Pollos Hermanos in Michoacán. Shortly thereafter, those same men showed up. They wanted money. And I'm ashamed to say that I paid them. You see, in that place, at that time, if I wished to conduct my business, I had no choice. But yesterday they came here. Here. They intimidated my customers. They threatened my employees. And again, they wanted money. Now, my friends, I must confess that I almost gave them what they wanted. But then I thought, no, this is America. Here, the righteous have no reason to fear. Here, those men have no power. And when they saw that I had no fear of them, they ran, like the cowards they are, back across the border. They will not return. We will move on from this. My friends, I promise you that together we will prosper.
All right.
Giancarlo Esposito, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that scene. I could listen to that over and over and over again. And it's such a great moment because you seem like like the perfect manager. You're thoughtful. You're concerned about your staff and want to protect them. You're standing up to bullies. You're patriotic about America. I'd like to talk with you about your voice as Gus. It's a very kind of measured voice. You articulate every syllable. It's a very conscious way of speaking, and you also have the slight remains of an accent from, I forget which country Gus is from.
Chile,
yeah. Okay. So can you talk about constructing that voice for Gus?
Yes. I try to let the words speak to me and jump off the page in silence so that I can hear the rhythm of what they are trying to write. In this case, obviously, Gus has a Chilean accent, which I bring to the copy, and then allowing my voice to join it in a whisper. And then from that whisper comes a sound so that I can allow what the writers have honored in this character and my voice to join together in a seamless way. I'm half Italian and half African-American, so I gesticulate. I'm very Italian. If you met me in person, I use my hands to speak. I wanted that to be diminished, and I wanted the calm and cool personality of Gus to emerge. So that whisper allowed me to relax and Giancarlo to go away.
You know, we heard a clip in which you're showing your generous businessman, generous employer side of yourself. I want to show the other side for a moment here. And this is a scene from Breaking Bad, where your people have brought Walt, the Bryan Cranston character, to the desert to meet with you. And you are worried about several things that Walt is doing, because Walt has really gone off the rails. But among the things you're worried about is Walt's brother-in-law, who's a DEA agent who's been trying to investigate where this crystal meth is coming from, who's cooking it, he doesn't realize that it's Walt, and who's distributing it, and he's kind of getting close to finding out that it's you. So here you are asking Walt, who's kind of on his knees in the desert before you, asking about Walt's brother-in-law.
In the meantime, there's the matter of your brother-in-law. He is a problem you promised to resolve. You have failed. Now it's left to me to deal with him. You can't. If you try to interfere, this becomes a much simpler matter. I will kill your wife. I will kill your son. I will kill your infant daughter.
Okay, so when you saw those lines in the script, I will kill your wife, I will kill your son, I will kill your infant daughter, what was your reaction to that line, and how did you decide how you wanted to say it?
I was really blown away by this particular scene, and I thought I could go two ways. I could be, you know, an extrovert with these lines, or I could stay within the character I created and just whisper this very unveiled threat. I was a little shaken. I have children. I know Bryan has children. I'm looking at Walter White, and I'm allowing him to know that he has not only failed with Hank, but he's also failed with me. Walter would have been the perfect partner, the perfect person to start another business somewhere else with if he had only done the right thing.
So let's talk about you. Your father is Italian, and by that I mean from Italy, and your mother's African-American from Alabama?
That's correct.
And you spent the early years of your life in Europe. How long were you there, and which country or countries were you in before moving to the U.S.?
I was born in Copenhagen, Denmark in 1958, and my mother was performing with Josephine Baker at the time.
Oh, no, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And, rich history in that background of musicals and singing and opera. She was singing opera also at the Hamburg Staatsoper. So we bounced between Copenhagen and Hamburg and then to Rome, of course. My father was from Naples, and so we wound up living in Rome until I was 5 years old. And I came over when I was five on the QE2 and landed in Manhattan at 43rd Street and 10th Avenue.
Well, okay, so your mother, as an African-American opera singer, did she get many roles? I mean, I think there's more opportunity today for opera singers of color than there was, when was this, the 1960s, late 1950s?
Yeah, late 50s. Yes, and she had performed with Leontine Price in a show called Porgy and Bess, which brought her to Europe. Bess was such a very strenuous role to play, so she alternated Bess with Leontine Price and then created another role in the show called Dancing Ruby, which was not in the original production. So she had a little moment where she could dance because she was an incredible dancer and singer.
Did she ever get frustrated because of the lack of opportunities for black opera singers?
Absolutely. She won the Marian Anderson Scholarship to come to New York from Cleveland, Ohio's Karamu House. And she went to International House to do her training before she went to Europe. I think that frustration eventually moved her out of the business. There weren't those opportunities. And obviously, at that period of time, there was a different feeling surrounding African-Americans and performing. And I really feel that she could have been a groundbreaker had she had a little more time to fight the good fight. It's a difficult period of time for both of my mother and father, Giovanni, and my mother was Lisa Foster, because they were in Europe at the time and they had two little interracial children. And so back then, even in Europe, it was looked at as a bit of taboo. So it was a very, very stressful time for both my parents at that moment in time.
I remember you saying when we first spoke in, I don't know, around 1990, that when you were in school, that you weren't accepted either by the Italian-Americans or the African-Americans because they each saw you as being the other. And that must have affected your sense of that you didn't want to be a color. You wanted to just be a person.
You know, absolutely. Look, when we still check those boxes, right? And it says African-American, Spanish, you know, Indian. And I, all my life, have checked the box that said other. Now, there is a connotation to that, too. I'm an other? How did I get to be an other? I had to make a choice, and I've made this choice over and over and over again in my life. I walk into an audition, and I'm Giancarlo Esposito. They thought I was a white guy, and they have to come to me. And I walk into the audition, and there's all white guys sitting out in the waiting room, and they come out, and they're oh, we're so sorry. We had no idea. And I said, what do you mean? We had no idea that you were black. So this is only for white guys. So I've had to revisit this often, and I'm getting a little choked up now because I believe that we hold ourselves in a way that also projects who we are. And if I project my humanity and I'm a human being, that goes beyond any color. It goes to the soul. It goes to, I want to be judged on meritocracy. I want to be judged for who I am organically. I want to have real interactions, not based on my color.
So when you'd go to an audition, somebody assumed based on your name that you'd be white, and then they'd have to tell you, oh, no, this is a role for white people, not for you. Would you try to talk your way into the role and convince them that you could play the part even though you weren't white and that character didn't have to be white? Or did you just leave? I mean, how did you figure out how to handle it?
It was a devastating moment where devastating and also very sweet when I stood up and said, well, why? Okay, give me a shot. Why can't I go in? So it took me time to stand up. The first few times it happened, I walked out crushed, devastated, hurt. And then I said, no, you don't need to be hurt, crushed, and devastated. You can stand up and be proud of who you are as a human being and tell them. My agent, manager, Toby Gibson, God rest her soul, used to say to me, go to the audition, but don't say anything. Don't talk. I would say, why? Because it's for a black guy, and you speak too well. So if you go in and just don't talk, you have brown skin, you can look tough. Look tough. Put a bandana around your head and don't say anything. So that was also a crushing moment because she was saying, don't show them how articulate you are, how intelligent you are. Just be the tough black kid.
So how old were you when your parents divorced?
I was 9 years old.
You were living in the U.S. by then?
I was. So I was living in Yonkers, New York, in a basement apartment.
Did your father and mother stay in the same neighborhood? And who did you stay with?
I stayed with my mother and my brother. My father was a gypsy. He was a stage hand and carpenter, and he traveled the world from show to show. And it's this moment in my life that I feel very much like him. They say you become your parents. I have that gypsy life going from film to theater all over the world and always living out of hotel rooms. Well, that was, we were alone. And he did not, unfortunately, did not give us much support. And it was because of their separation and divorce that I started to want to help financially, knew I had talent. My mother was an opera singer. I have a great voice. So I thought I could just start working. And that would help the family, and it would also allow me to get out of school, you know, get out of jail free, didn't have to go to school. I could correspond my work. But I loved the theater. I found that I loved it, and it was a means for me to not only develop a craft, but also to help my mom pay for myself and my brother.
What was the importance of Spike Lee in your life? You made 3 movies with him in the late 80s and early 90s. I think it's 3. School Days, Do the Right Thing, and Mo Better Blues.
And I also did Jungle Fever. So
oh, that Jungle
makes
Fever,
it 4,
right.
And Malcolm X makes it 5. It's 5.
Oh, my gosh, right. Okay.
No worries. It's all right.
Right. Okay, so you had at some point rejected being like, you know, the drug dealer, the crack addict kind of character. You wanted to play, you know, more positive roles and not just represent African Americans in those kinds of roles. And you talked about the problem you had getting roles. So with Spike Lee, here's somebody who's of your generation, who's African-American and is trying to write movies that address issues that real people face. So was that a real turning point in your life, like finding Spike Lee?
A very specific turning point. To be able to find Spike Lee, I had been doing a show called Zoo Man and the Sun, and Spike came to see that play by Charles Fuller.
With the Negro Ensemble Company.
With the Negro Ensemble Company, and he was very enamored with my performance and asked me to read a script called School Days, which was, at that period of time, a musical.
Oh, gosh, really?
Yeah, it was a musical. It was about his experience at Morehouse College, Morehouse and Clark in Atlanta. And I read the script and I was excited. I used to go visit him down at Maxie Cohen's first run features, where he would be cleaning the films and he'd be wearing little white gloves and he'd be using the Steenbeck and rolling the film around on the big reel. It was a definitive turning point in my life to work with Spike Lee, because Spike represented the truth who African Americans were at that period of time. He didn't pull any punches. He wrote what he saw. He wrote what he felt, as raw as it may have been, as hard as it may have been to digest for African Americans. And so I respected Spike for changing the game in film.
And did you have long conversations with him about race?
Oh, my goodness. We became friends. And are you kidding me? Yes. And so because I have, I'm a mixed race guy, I took a little issue when Spike said, "Hey, Giancarlo, you, I got to tell you this." I said, "What, Spike?" "You're an Afro-European." That's what he called me. And I went, "Okay, Spike, we've butted heads. We've disagreed. We've agreed. I guess that's what friendships are about." He helped me to think. He was so pro-black on certain of his sets where I didn't like it when, he would talk about white folks a certain way and then have white folks on the set. I was like, "Well, what is that? Like, how do you do that?" He's been instrumental in training young African-American filmmakers and being an inspiration to so many people. I loved our disagreements and I loved our agreements. And I just really appreciate his fresh attitude that he brought to filmmaking.
Well, since we're speaking about your relationship with Spike Lee, why don't we play a scene from Do the Right Thing? And this is a scene where you play Buggin' Out, who's a character, as you just you described him in 1990 as somebody, when I interviewed you, as somebody who's probably read like one paragraph of a speech by Martin Luther King or like one paragraph from the autobiography of Malcolm X and decided to be a change maker, but he really knows nothing about history or about how to make change. So he's often doing the wrong thing.
Exactly.
So this scene is at the pizzeria, which is run by Sal, played by Danny Aiello. And there's a lot of white performers on Sal's wall of fame in the pizzeria. And your character, Buggin' Out, objects to that and thinks that there should be black people on the wall, too. So here's the scene.
Hey, Sal, how come getting the brothers up on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy,
and
huh?
And you, hey, don't stop with me today.
What? Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
You looking for trouble?
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble?
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
Okay, that's Danny Aiello. And my guest, Giancarlo Esposito in Do the Right Thing. So in some ways, that film is all about like racial division between the white characters and the black characters and the misunderstandings between them and the hostility between them. What was it like for you to be a film about divisiveness when in your life you were trying to kind of like transcend race and bring people together and see their humanity and not their race?
I, again, stick to Spike Lee was telling the truth at that point in time, and speaking about this movie today, It was, in a very strange way, a foreboding of what is still going on. And I applaud what Spike does in the world politically to bring attention to all the young black youth that are dying at the hands of police. What was it like? It got me, it snapped me back into reality. You know, no matter what I think of myself in the world, I have brown skin. And that's going to be measured. And I have to be aware, even today, that anything can happen. Yes, one moment people can recognize me for as bugging out from Do the Right Thing and or from as Gus from Breaking Bad. But in another moment, I may just be looked at as a black man with a tail light out who is reaching for his wallet that could be a gun.
Giancarlo Esposito, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Giancarlo Esposito plays Gus Fring on AMC's Better Call Saul. Esposito is also in the new film Okja by South Korean director Bong Joon-ho, who also directed Snowpiercer. It will be on Netflix and in select theaters starting June 28th. Journeys near and far into the past and even into space are the subject of the novels, memoirs, and narrative histories that make up our book critic Maureen Corrigan's early summer reading list. Here are her recommendations.
There's still time to make travel plans for August 21st. That's the date when a total solar eclipse will cross the continental United States, the first such eclipse in 99 years. The total eclipse can only be witnessed within a 70-mile-wide path called the Path of Totality, which stretches from Oregon to South Carolina. According to David Barron, it's nature's most awesome show. And he should know. Barron is a self-professed umbrophile, or eclipse chaser. He's also a science writer who's just written a suspenseful narrative history about the last total solar eclipse to cross North America in the summer of 1878. Barron's book is called American Eclipse, and it follows a group of 19th century adventurers who raced out to the Rocky Mountains to study the last eclipse up close. 31-year-old Thomas Edison was one of this intrepid band. Another was astronomy professor Mariah Mitchell, who took some of her Vassar students out to Colorado to prove that women could do science too. As the eclipse got underway, Barron vividly describes how the temperature plummeted, nocturnal animals emerged from hiding, and familiar colors of mountains and trees shifted. The total eclipse itself lasted about 3 minutes, the same span of time predicted for the upcoming August 21st eclipse. But Barron makes those 3 minutes seem transcendent. Experiencing a total eclipse, he says, is like falling through a trapdoor into a dimly lit, unrecognizable reality. The sun and the moon are thoroughly foreign, an ebony pupil surrounded by a pearly iris. It is the eye of the cosmos. If David Barron is obsessed with eclipses, Helene Stepinski is obsessed with family history. But she's not one of those genealogy bores, predictably intent on proving her relation to royalty. Rather, Stepinski wants to get to the bottom of a long-ago murder case that propelled her great-great-grandmother Vida from southern Italy to Jersey City in 1892. Stepinski's atmospheric new book, Murder in Matera, is part memoir, fiction, and travelogue, and it reads like a detective story, with Stepinski playing the part of her clan's Columbo. As she tantalizingly tells readers in her introduction, by the end of her 10-year investigation, Stepinski would travel deep into the countryside and dusty archives of southern Italy and discover one shotgun blast and five dead bodies, most of them belonging to my family. Transatlantic family calamities of a more comic sort are the subject of Francesca Siegel's novel of manners called The Awkward Age. Siegel's heroine, Julia Alden, is a middle-aged widow with a teenage daughter. Julia has fallen for a divorced American obstetrician with a teenage son. The foursome move in together into Julia's North London home, and the teenagers at first loathe each other. But when a truce is called, trouble of the erotic sort ensues. This is a smart and droll domestic drama reminiscent of the work of those two magical Lauries, Laurie Colwin and Laurie Moore. Two American writers with one-of-a-kind voices and sensibilities have written superb new memoirs about their parents. To my way of thinking, nobody gives ordinary human beings their due with the grace and precision that Richard Ford does. His slim new memoir about his parents, called Between Them, is so gently spellbinding that I've already read it twice. Ford's father was a traveling bleach salesman in places like Mobile and Little Rock during the 1930s and early 40s. So part of the bonus of this little book is that it sits readers down in the company car and takes us on an unsentimental but enchanted journey through the long-ago landscape of the American South. According to Sherman Alexie, his mother Lillian was a beauty, a liar, a sometimes loving, sometimes abusive parent who lost custody of her kids at least once, and a strong-willed woman who gave up drinking cold turkey one day and never looked back. I'm just skimming the surface of Alexie's portrait of his mother in his whirlwind of a memoir called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. There's straight personal history here, as well as fable, poetry, and raw and mordant accounts of life on the Spokane Indian Reservation where Alexie grew up. Unexpected revelations are a constant throughout this memoir. At one point, Alexie tells us, "White folks love to think that Native American culture is progressive and liberal, but it is often repressive. Indians are quick to socially judge one another. I wouldn't realize it until I read more widely in college, but living on an Indian reservation was like living inside an Edith Wharton novel, a place where good and bad manners were weaponized." For decades, the weapon of choice in John Grisham's thrillers has been his main character's quick wits. This summer, Grisham is publishing his 30th novel. This one is a standalone, and it's the perfect beach book for bibliophiles. Camino Island is a heist caper that begins when a gang of thieves successfully steals a priceless literary treasure, the handwritten manuscripts of F. Scott Fitzgerald's 5 novels, which are kept in a vault deep in Princeton's Firestone Library. I've been there. This could never happen. But as usual, Grisham is such a deft suspense writer, he makes me believe. Even if you can't get yourself to the solar eclipse's path of totality this August 21st, any of these very different books will get you onto the path of a totally good story.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, photojournalist Paul Nicklin will talk about his work in the Arctic and Antarctica, taking pictures of polar bears, penguins, and sea animals, and documenting the impact of climate change. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the most dramatic consequences of climate change are happening out of view of most people in the Arctic and Antarctica. But you can see some of those changes in the dramatic and beautiful photos taken by my guest, Paul Nicklin. He describes himself as a conservation photographer. He's been photographing the Arctic and Antarctica since 1995, taking pictures of polar bears, penguins, sea animals, and the ice. He spent a lot of time in frigid waters taking underwater photos. The threat of hyperthermia and of getting attacked by predators makes it a risky business. Despite the inhospitable temperatures he works in, Nicklin feels at home. He grew up in an Inuit community just a few hundred miles from the North Pole. Niklan recently returned from Svalbard, Norway, in the Arctic Circle, where he documented the effects of the melting permafrost. Paul Niklan, welcome to Fresh Air. One of your most famous photos has to do with melting in Svalbard. This is a photo that Al Gore has used to illustrate the changes caused by climate change. And it's basically like a glacier that's become a waterfall because of melting ice.
It was a really traumatic day because we had been photographing polar bears and traveling around Svalbard. There was no sea ice to be found anywhere. The bears were stranded on land. And I was actually had philanthropists who I was guiding, bringing with us to show them what's at stake. And that day in the morning, I had found them finally some polar bears that were sleeping. And we sat there waiting for hours for the bears to get up until I realized that the bears were probably never going to get up. And I walked up to the bears and they were both dead. They had starved to death and they were young 3-year-old bears on the shores of Svalbard. And it was just a gut-wrenching moment. And then later that night, we had to move the vessel because of a really big storm was coming in. Winds were up to 80 knots. And we came around down behind the ice cap of Nordaustland at the northeast ice cap of Svalbard just to get out of the wind from the storm. And as the light hit this ice face of the ice cap, to look back and to see, not only was the outside temperature 68 degrees Fahrenheit, but to see 20 waterfalls in a row just gushing off the top of this ice cap. And then you start to tie that to the science that's coming out. That is first time in recorded history that the entire ice cap of Greenland is melting. And then, it was just a really powerful, humbling moment. And I felt very lucky to be able to capture all these waterfalls, pouring off the top of this ice cap.
Now, you mentioned the photograph that you took in 2014 of a dead polar bear, and you'd found two dead polar bears on that trip. How does that connect to climate change?
I was a biologist. I worked on polar bears and helped, look at population dynamics and movement patterns. And, in all those years of flying around in helicopters and driving across the sea ice on snowmobiles and looking for bears, I never found a dead polar bear. For some reason, you very rarely find dead bears. And in the last 20 years, to have the scientists talking about how we're reaching the lowest extent of ice we've ever had. A place like Svalbard, Norway, historically has been covered by sea ice year-round. And in the last 20 to 30 years, that ice has been just in a few fjords. And then now, in the last few years, there's been no ice at all around Svalbard. There's been a little strip down the east side. And when there's no ice, that means bears basically do not have that platform to catch seals, and that's their main food source. They might eat a little bit of seaweed, but they might get the odd bird egg or the odd bird, but that's not giving them any nutritional value. Essentially, bears are designed to go on land for long periods of time. They can be on land for 2 months and not eat a meal, but they're not designed to go 4 or 5 or 6 months on land without eating any food. And that's where we're starting to find emaciated bears, dead bears, in Alaska, in the Beaufort, where there's really ice has taken a beating. They're finding dead bears floating out in the sea. And these are most likely bears that have attempted to swim from the ice pack in the summer and the fall back to land. And if they have to swim, several hundred miles and they're already a skinny bear, they are going to suffer from hypothermia as well. So when you start to see these examples, but it's time to have hope too, in the sense that this year I went looking for skinny bears and there was a lot of ice in Svalbard. Compared to the last 20 years, it was a pretty good ice year, but compared to 40 years ago, it was still a bad ice year. But we found some, really fat, heavy bears that could hardly walk. They were so fat just because they're getting to hunt late into the season. And you just see how tied they are to their food source. If they don't have seals, they're going to get hungry. If they have seals, you're going to get fat bears.
So you photographed like many, many polar bears, and you've seen about 2,000 of them. And I think it's easy for people in some ways to relate to polar bears because they're just so impressive and attractive looking. But you also spend a lot of time photographing creatures that, aren't going to be like cute or impressive like that by people's standards, So I'm thinking here of like the narwhal, which is, let me ask you to describe what a narwhal is.
Yeah, it's so funny when I do lectures in audiences of sometimes a couple thousand people, and I'm like, I get so excited, like, who knows what a narwhal is? And you see maybe 100 hands go up out of 2,000, and you just sort of assume that everybody knows what a narwhal is. I mean, it's just funny that we're so in love with unicorns, the horse with a tusk, and all of a sudden there really is a unicorn out there. It just happens to be in something so much more amazing to see a 16-foot-long whale, and it has doesn't have any teeth in its mouth, but it has two teeth that grow out of its upper jaw, and they go straight out from their head, and so it goes out in a left helix spiral, and that's the tusk of the narwhal. So it's a 16-foot-long whale, and really big tusks can grow up to 11 feet, and very, very rarely do both teeth actually protrude and grow out from the upper jaw, and that gets, you know, they call them double tuskers, but sometimes you can, you know, see this poor whale that has to swim around with probably, you know, 40, 50 pounds of ivory strapped to its head, you know, that's 11 feet long. It's got a lot to carry around in the ice, especially.
So these are like whales with an ivory spear attached to its head.
It's basically a beluga whale that's got this grayish speckled color that has, yeah, a long ivory tusk, you know, that's up to 11 feet.
So we've been talking about your photography in the Arctic. Let's switch to Antarctica, where you've also done a lot of photography. And among
yes.
the sea animals that you photograph there is the leopard seal. Would you describe the leopard seal?
You know, leopard seals are fascinating to look at. They're 12 feet long. You know, it's a really big one, 1,000 pounds. They have this serpentine-like body. They're very lean and slender, and they have these massive pectoral flippers that allow them to turn on a dime underwater. They have these big reptilian heads with these massive jaws and these sort of dark holes for eyes. Like there's like almost like this just sinister look to them. But you just have to see one to really just sort of fall in love with them. They're just such characters.
So you wanted to photograph them and you got your chance when one started banging against your boat in a kind of threatening way. Would you describe the circumstance that led to you getting in the water?
Yeah, I wanted to go to Antarctica and get to know as many leopard seals as I could to give them a fair shake. I never really think animals are vicious or out to get humans. And so I worked with a friend of mine named Jordan Elme from Sweden. And I called him up, and he'd been in the water with leopard seals a couple of times. And I said, what do you think? Are they vicious? And he said, no, they're fantastic animals, but they're complex. You just have to really get to know them. And once you get to know them, it can be great. So he and I went off to Antarctica together on a small sailboat. And arrived there, and the first day we showed up on the peninsula, and we went out in the little Zodiac that was 12 feet long, and this right away this leopard seal came up to us, and she was as long or longer than the boat, and he just said, that is a bloody big seal, yeah, just to quote him exactly. He just said, that's, you know, it's a huge seal, and he said, this is good. The bigger they are, the more confident they are, the more they're going to interact with you. And so that big seal grabbed a penguin right away, came up underneath the hull of the boat and started to ram it against the bottom of the boat. And then she went away from the boat with this penguin, almost knocked us over the edge of the boat. And then she goes about 10 feet away from the boat and she grabs it by the neck and does this death shake where they shake them so hard from side to side that they try and turn them inside out so the feathers come off their body and they can eat the meat. So the leopard seal does that. So there's guts in the water. There's blood everywhere. There's, you know, bits of penguin. And this is all sort of in the first half an hour of me seeing a leopard seal. And Jordan said to me, this is a great situation. It's time for you to get in the water, yeah? You know, with his thick Swedish accent. And at that point, I'm a pretty brave guy, and I always give animals the benefit of the doubt. But everything in my body was saying, don't do it. Do not get in the water. And so I said to Jordan, you know, hey, dude, it's just my first seal. Let's do it tomorrow. And he said, and he started to yell at me. He says, it's 10 in the morning. You've complained all the time. There's not enough budget and not enough time. You're, scared of failing a story for National Geographic. He goes, I tell you now to shut up and you get in the water, yeah? And I just looked at this guy yelling at me, and I looked at this massive seal, and I'm like, he's right. You know, I've come here to photograph this seal and get to know it. This is no time to chicken out. And I put on my hood and my dry suit, sealed it up, and put my fins on, and my mouth was like so dry, like parched dry mouth. Put my snorkel in my mouth and slipped over the edge of the boat. And things appear 30% larger underwater than they do above water. So however big she looked above water, she looked 30% larger underwater. So she looked like the size of a beluga whale to me, and this massive head, and she was huge. And she just dropped her penguin and she came shooting over to me. And she opened up her mouth, which is, you know, her head's twice as big as a grizzly bear's. And now I'm staring down her throat. Her canines are two above my head and my camera and two are below. And I'm staring down her throat. And luckily for me, every time I took a picture, my shutter went black. The more I shot, the less I could see. I made the mistake once of looking over my camera. When you're looking at something through a really wide angle lens, like a fisheye, they appear tiny. But when I looked over my camera, I realized truly how massive this animal was.
Let me stop you right here. You have one photograph where it looks like the camera is nearly inside the mouth of this predator.
Yeah, yeah.
And the mouth is wide open. You can, like, if this creature had tonsils, you'd be seeing it. And you see, like, the really many and sharp teeth that this leopard seal has. And you've written that you were, like, in and out of this leopard seal's mouth.
Just my camera was in and out of the mouth, but, I mean, my eye is attached to the camera, so...
Was your camera in and out of the mouth because you wanted it there or because the leopard seal wanted you in his mouth?
Well, this is a female, so females are 25 to 30% bigger than males, so they have sexual dimorphism, and so this was a massive female. They need that extra size to give birth to their pups on the ice and to survive, so this was, you know, the perfect large seal, and yeah, my camera was in her mouth, and it was more, she was, when I do deal with polar bears or grizzly bears or any of these incredible top predators, I let them dictate the encounter. I don't want to harass them, push them, change their behavior, but this was all her. So all I did was lie there motionless. I didn't move. I let her check me out. I let her go through this whole series of threat displays that she was doing to me to establish her dominance. Because you have to think that she is on this incredible penguin rookery, and there's, you know, thousands of penguins, and she's eating penguins all morning as they go to sea. And I just showed up and jumped into her territory, and she's chased every other leopard seal out of her territory. And all of a sudden, here's this cocky person who maybe she hasn't even seen a human before, but she was going to figure out what I was doing in her territory. And she started off with this threat display that never felt terrifying. It was just incredible. It was just big and powerful, but it didn't look like it was ever going to bite me. Another thing that's fascinating about leopard seals is when you look at these animals, when you look at elephant seals or fur seals, they're covered in scars and bite marks, and walrus are always hitting each other. You look at a leopard seal, they're perfectly clean. They're shiny, sleek, silver bodies. They have no scars on their bodies. They don't fight by biting each other all the time. They fight through gesture and display and these threat displays. And so this is what this seal was doing. It was communicating with me. It wasn't coming up to bite me, but it was establishing its dominance, which I was happy to concede.
And at some point, it started feeding you penguins. So
yeah,
you have a great picture of this leopard seal with half a penguin in its mouth, like the bottom half, like the feet and the torso, coming at you to offer you a piece of penguin. It's such a crazy picture.
Yeah, it was an incredible situation. And, you know, this leopard seal stayed with me for 4 days straight. And every time I would show up on the water, she'd be there to greet me. She would follow me back to the sailboat at night. And once she established her dominance, she completely relaxed, and then she disappeared, and I thought the encounter was over. And then she showed up a few minutes later with a penguin in her mouth. She had just caught a penguin chick. She was holding it by the feet, and the penguin's flapping, trying to get away from her, and she would just sort of line it up with me, and when it was lined up perfectly with me, she would let it go, and it would swim off. She caught it. She did this over and over, and I realized at that moment that she was trying to feed me a live penguin. And I think she realized quickly in this encounter that I was not capable of catching a live, moving, swimming penguin. And so she brought me another penguin. She did all these different attempts to feed me live penguins. And at one point, I think there's a photo of her looking dejected, sort of disappointed in me that I'm sort of so useless that I'm unable to catch or accept one of her gifts. So then she started to bring me dead penguins. And at one point, I had five penguins floating around my head. And the picture you're talking about is further on in the encounter when she got so tired of me being unable to accept one of her penguins that she grabbed it and she flipped it on top of my head. And that's where you have the feet sort of lying on my camera. The head sort of, you know, she kept throwing penguins on me, and then she'd poke me in the ribs. She'd come around beside me as the penguin's floating on top of my camera, and she'd sort of poke me with her whiskers in my cheek. You know, and I'm trying to shoot, but I'm laughing so hard in my mask that it's flooding my seal. So I'm trying to see through this mask. It's filling up with seawater as she's just determined, like this OCD determination to get me to eat a penguin. Because if I accept a penguin, then she knows exactly why I'm there. But the more I rejected her penguin offerings, the more confused she became, the more OCD, the more determined she became to give me one of her offerings.
So it sounds like you were kind of falling in love with this leopard seal. Do you feel like you learned something that other people didn't know about leopard seals?
I think I learned, I mean, I definitely fell in love with this seal. I mean, I would, I mean, it's embarrassing to admit this to you, apparently you have a lot of followers, to admit this on your radio show, is, you know, I'd fall asleep at night with tears coming down my cheeks, just so, sorry, I'm just remembering it, but yeah, I was just so grateful, you know, just to spend your life out with animals and to be fighting to get yourself into a situation where you can try and get close, where you can try and, you know, just even get within 100 meters of something. And all of a sudden, here's a top predator. And not only you're getting to see it, it's interacting with you. It's trying to force feed you penguins. It's trying to take care of you. It's a very, very humbling thing. And so what you learn about these animals is how communicative they are, how intelligent they are, how social they are, and sort of how forgiving they are. And it's just to flop yourself into its world and for it to spend that much time and energy trying to figure out who you are and to interact with you. And then the encounter went further from there. I think that's why I get emotional, is because we had such a connection. And then near the end of the project, I was in the water and she came up to me and she did this really aggressive threat display. She went upside down. She did this guttural sort of gut, and I could feel it vibrate through my whole body. And I thought, okay, now she's upset. I've pushed her too far. She's going to attack. What had happened was another big leopard seal had snuck up behind me and she did that threat display and she chased that leopard seal away from me. And that other leopard seal too had a penguin in its mouth. And she took that penguin away from that leopard seal and brought that penguin back and gave that to me as well. So yeah, it was pretty powerful.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for going to the places that most of us will never be able to get to and bringing back images from there. Thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this chance to talk with you.
Paul Nicklin is the co-founder of Sea Legacy. You can see a slideshow of Nicklin's photographs on our website. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.